there are so many things about Sontag that I was drawn to, sort of as an undergraduate originally. It was the first exposure to her work was on photography, which is one of the seminal texts about photography theory. And pretty much every undergraduate student who's worth their salt needs to read this book, and definitely graduate students. She talks a lot about photography as masks. She talks about portraiture in a contemporary sense. That book, I have a copy that's, it just looks ragged, and I have so many notes, and it's just one of those books you go through again and again. And then later realizing, and I don't think it was even as an undergraduate, but I realized that she was such a prolific author and also wrote fiction. And then beyond photography, this sort of ongoing fight of hers to draw out of culture what was always referred to as low art being taken seriously, whether it was commercials or comic books or films. These kinds of things that the establishment had always looked at as mass-produced art or art that was produced by groups of people, which to me is ludicrous because art history has, it's rife with examples of people who are combining their skills to create a work of art. But something like a film, for instance, this is not just the director, not just the writer, it's a large group of people putting this together normally. And so her constant fight against this highbrow idea of what art is, I thought that was incredible. And then her path crossing with Annie Leibovitz, and they were partners for years. And again, this is an interesting mix of a highbrow, and she wouldn't call herself this, but Sontag being a, more of a highbrow philosopher and critic, crossing over with a person who did a lot of photographs of lowbrow celebrities or somebody who might be considered a commercial photographer. And these two coming together and a lot of people who were in their circles saying, oh, this is a perfect pairing of two people. That was really wonderful too. So those three areas, I think, are what drew me to Sontag originally. Oh, this is my first thought. The metaphor that popped in my head was a spicy meatball. I thought this was, it was extraordinarily dense in terms of, it seemed like she wanted to go in so many different directions. And yet she still kept several themes going throughout the lecture. The points that she seemed to be trying to make were challenging old, often male ideals and ideas, especially in art. The idea of old versus new and what those definitions were. There was a constant sense of a defense of modernism. But what she referred to as modernism in this lecture, often I think she was talking about more contemporary art, and for the time I mean like 1950s and 1960s contemporary art. But then also going back to the modernist period, maybe 1880 to 1930, probably the thing that she was the most concerned about in the theme of the interview was this new sensibility that she was trying to push on her audience, gently push on her audience, which was for about a century or even more, we've had a separation of the sciences and the arts. And she defined very clearly, philosophically, what that was, what that separation was. We had sort of the art being internal, in ingestion, a cultivation, I think those were the words she used. And then science being more external and an accumulation and a complexity. And I thought was very interesting was that, whether this is Freudian or not, she seemed to refer to literature and art a little bit more from a feminine perspective, and I mean a psychological feminine perspective, which is often, you know, we look at the internal, we look at something that's cultivated, and then science being this sort of overly male, external, you know, accumulation, and this sort of more aggressive in some ways. I thought that was fascinating, and she didn't go too much into the gender of this, but it sort of hinted in that direction. She also, throughout this, emphasized reading, which wasn't a surprise because she is part of literature and part of criticism. She emphasized pluralism, which comes back to the idea of high versus low, and we shouldn't make those distinctions necessarily, especially when we're talking about criticism and analysis. And then talking specifically again about not enough about science intersecting with art at that point, not enough talking about that still, you know, we have to separate these two things. So those were, I mean, in a 50-minute speech, it was extraordinary how many different things she touched on. And then there's sort of where the interview went for me and some of the things that I was interested in and like to expand on. Would you mind if I talked about that a little bit? Well, I mean, what's exciting for me personally as an artist and somebody who's been working, I've worked at 5 different colleges, actually now 6, and someone who is a photographer, the idea of separating science and art is ludicrous to me. Science and art are a perfect marriage in photography, and they always have been. You've always had a history, even before Daguerre and some of the people who are lauded for the invention of photography. You have a history of people, and not just men, who experimented with chemistry and physics and light and actual chemicals. But then on the other side of this, many of them had a deep interest in the humanities and the arts. Many of them painters or people who would draw and were looking for a way to draw with light without having to do it with your hand. So photography being, and it makes sense to me that she would be drawn to photography and write about it so extensively because photo is such a marriage of these two. So she puts to rest, or she attempts to in this wonderful lecture, the idea of science and art not being separated, you know, just saying no to that. And then again, this idea of high and low, the idea that, well, we can talk about painting and sculpture as traditional media, and that's what's valid, but a comic book or an assemblage or mixed media or something like that, something from those areas, well, that's not worthy, or that's not something we're going to talk about. At this time, 1965, I had to keep reminding myself that this was 65 when she spoke, which is extraordinary. That's more than 50 years ago. She's talking about the idea of people like Joseph Cornell, for instance. She didn't mention his name, but people who are mixed media artists, people who are showing in galleries at the time, people who are getting purchased by museums who are not doing at all what traditional artists have done and working in many different mediums at the same time. This is also the advent and the start in the mid-60s of a lot of video art, for instance, the very beginning of video art, performance art, land art, sculpture outside, so many different areas of different kinds of areas and experimental kinds of areas of art. And she draws that connection at one point between the idea of experimentation in art, which is such an important part of science. I also think of things like Kodak. You know, how many artists have used Kodak materials for their own work, film cameras? And Kodak employed hundreds and hundreds of scientists to create a means to be creative. And this is a little capitalist, but this is a great example of how we work as a culture to bring science and art together in a very beautiful way. Another thing that struck me about this is that the lecture is pre-internet. And I had to keep reminding myself of that because she's talking about media in a very general sense, but she's not yet talking about online, the web, social media, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, any of these applications. This is really fascinating. She talks about Marshall McLuhan as if he's somebody new, and he wasn't new, but he was becoming more prominent at that time. And I think she called, I have the quote here where she started to talk about McLuhan. She said, she really pushed him on the audience at Antioch and saying that he was astoundingly right. That was her quote. Those were her words. And she had a quote that I wrote down that I thought was interesting. He said, this is McLuhan, she was quoting him, the human history is a succession of acts of technological extension of human capacity, each of which works a radical change upon our environment and ways of thinking and feeling and valuing. So for her at the time, I think it was this emergence or this convergence of different forms of art and an experimentation going in new directions. Yes, painting, of course, is valid and drawing and sculpture, and they always will be, but what can I do creatively with video? What can I do creatively with the earth itself in terms of three-dimensional sculpture outside? What can I do with sound as an art form? These were relatively new ideas. Not that they hadn't been experimented with before by maybe the Surrealists or before in other movements, but but this is really coming to the fore when she's giving this lecture. That was fascinating. And then taking it a little bit further, I started thinking about how her lecture dovetailed beautifully with what is happening right now with the internet and how artists are using the internet or resources in the internet or on the internet to create their own work. How social media, Facebook, again, Twitter, Snapchat, all of these applications are becoming so important in how we communicate for better or for worse. And that would be probably a lecture in and of itself, or maybe a symposium in and of itself. And then I also thought, going from her to her quotes and her admiration of McLuhan's writing, Marshall McLuhan, and then going to, I jumped to Paul Virilio, who is one of my favorite philosophers. His work can be incredibly dense, but I think it's so important. And he had one quote that haunts me, and I'm going to read it to you. He said, "Work occupies the center of time, while uncontrolled time of vacations and unemployment form a periphery, a suburbs of time, a clearing away of activities in which each person is exiled to a life of privacy and deprivation." And that, for me, describes perfectly something like, for instance, for my generation, Facebook. You can stay on Facebook and you can hate it, but if you go off it, then you are sort of in the suburbs of time. You have privacy to a certain extent, but then you're deprived of knowing what's going on in other people's lives. You're deprived of the idea of posting photographs of your family or your kid or what's going on with your career. That was really interesting to me. And that was a big jump from what Sontag was talking about to McLuhan, with what he was talking about with media, to Virilio. But this idea of privacy versus deprivation is really, really fascinating to me. The other thing about this is Virilio, that's from a book called Lost Dimension that he wrote. It's a compilation of essays, and that was from 1984. So that was well before the popular use of the internet. And then how many of the things that Sontag brings up can be related in a contemporary way in 50, I guess this is 51 years later, is incredible to me. And then the last thing that I liked is she mentioned, and she didn't agree with this, she was just sort of bringing it up, the idea of science being, the disciplines of science being neutral, morally neutral, okay, and the idea of art being morally committed, and this sort of being a zeitgeist that's been around for a while. That was very interesting. I think she's questioning that throughout her lecture, and I wish she had gone a little bit deeper. For me, we have to question this, because science, I think, can be very neutral, and the goal of science is to be neutral, to prove something empirically. You can't just say, I think there might be a black hole out in space somewhere. You know, I think it might be shaped like this. You have to sort of work to prove that. That's where science attempts to be very neutral. But then if we look at issues surrounding science, social issues, or we look at something like The Immortal Life of Henry the Lax by Rebecca Skloot. Here's an example of how science took cells without the knowledge of an African-American woman and used them for decades for cultures and for experiments. That is not neutral. That is not morally neutral. That is a much more complex issue that Skloot tackles in her book. Art, on the other hand, can it be morally committed? It is often morally committed and very subjective. I would maybe use an example of Edward Bertinsky. He is a current photographer, Canadian, contemporary. He has quite a few books about the impact his photographs show us very openly, in a devastating way, how we've worked to destroy the planet and how we're using our resources and just the impact that we've left. His photographs, by the way, will be, I think some of them will be on display at the Dayton Art Institute this fall. So there's a connection between being morally committed and art. Although when he lectures, he often doesn't necessarily take a side. He just sort of presents this and says, I want to allow you to have a conversation about what you're seeing here. If it's a coal pit or a some sort of dig that people have done, or in China, the kind of damage that they've done to their landscape in the pursuit of manufacturing. the part that I got, the one quarter of this, you know, we talked about morally neutral science versus not so morally neutral, morally committed art. The quadrant that I got to was not morally committed art or neutral art, which I thought is really idea. And I had to rack my brain a little bit to try and come up with some ideas for this. I'm not sure if art can ever be completely devoid of, you know, subjectivity or morality. You could look at forms, you could look at maybe constructivist painting that's basically just shapes on paper or shapes on a canvas. But even that, when I say constructivist art, then we're relating that to Russian politics of the time and what it meant to be a constructivist, and it's not. I had a much more difficult time trying to find something that was art that was not morally defined. That's a much more interesting conversation. So between science versus art, and that not being the case for her anymore, I mean Sontag, and not really being able to divorce that and where they were going with art, where our culture was going with art in the 1960s, the idea of the lecture being pre-internet and how so many of these things can be talked about right now in terms of or in reference to the internet and social media, and then the idea of science being morally neutral and art being morally committed is a very interesting discussion, and again, a lecture or a book in and of itself. So those are the areas that really, for me, were more interesting. Well, having read some of that corpus, you know, and not necessarily being a hard expert on Sontag, I didn't do a dissertation on her or anything, but I would say that Sontag made an effort to not be firmly ensconced in one area of academic study. She was so interested, obviously, in art and culture and art criticism and challenging the old and often very white male ideas of art criticism, but then writing about science as well, writing about what it's like to be sick, writing about cancer, writing about feelings. And she talked about this at least one point, maybe two during the lecture, about feelings and our reactions to and what makes us human being valid. And I thought that was fascinating. That is something that is a thread through a lot of her work, whether it is more scientifically based or about science or art or a combination of the two. It just struck me, this lecture, I mean, it's 50-plus minutes, how, and maybe I have you to thank for this, for picking this out, or whoever found this, this was brilliant, because so much of this can be and needs to be part of the discourse today surrounding art and a tendency that we have as human beings to categorize. Like, this has to be here. Even if we're talking about higher education, we have to have, this is part of the curriculum, but this doesn't matter for this particular degree. Or how much of a broad case for humanities are we going to make sure our students are exposed to, for instance? She makes the argument throughout this that there's validity to both, and they need not be separated so much. Between 1965 and now, we have seen an explosion of art, not just photography, but many different mediums that approach or are completely a mix of science and technology, whether it's more specific areas like biology, physics, astrophysics, and art. I saw a show recently at Owens Community College up in Toledo, where it was specifically about gleaning imagery from the internet that was already there, and what the artists chose to do with images that had already been made by other people. This is not necessarily a welcome idea from a traditionalist art standpoint, but is it still valid? I imagine Sontag, I shouldn't speak for her, but I imagine she would probably say that this is valid, and it's something that we could at least talk about in a critical way. She talked about in the lecture about the, I can't remember how she put it, I'd have to find it, but around World War I, the idea of science becoming something that nobody sees anymore because it becomes part of the, she didn't say the ether, but she was referring to things like radio. She was referring to things that are invisible. And that was the point where I was like, wait a minute, when was this recording? Because I had in my head this was 75 or 80, and then I'm like, this is 65. Okay, So this is really like just when corporations were starting to buy large computers and nobody knew how to use them, at least on a personal level. And then I thought, wow, that's amazing, because that's happening all over again with, we use this stuff, whether it's an app or an iPhone, and we have no idea how it's worked because it's self-contained and invisible. And then the corporations making it not easier for you to have access to how things work. What she said about radio and all of those industries back then was fascinating to me, because they did have a physical presence. You did know where a radio station was, or where an antenna was, or where a pipe was, or a track. Those were the things that she was talking about. Like, not all of a sudden it's kind of invisible about how things are made. But there was a physicality in terms of the manufacturing, but now it's code, it's out there, it's stored somewhere, it's invisible, we don't know where things are, we store something in the cloud, where does it go? This is a second kind of removal that related perfectly to what she was saying, but what's happening now is this other new removal that's even pushing people further away from how things are made or how an app is made or code or whatever. And it's harder. She talks about knowledge, too. If you don't have the knowledge, you can't make it. We don't even have the knowledge of where it is, much less of how to make it. That was a super profound part of it, and I forgot about that. That was a great part of the lecture.